Okay, tonight, as Michael indicated, we're going to continue our look at King Hezekiah. Chapters 36, 7, 8, and 9 are an excerpt from almost verbatim from 2 Kings 18 and following. And you might wonder, well, why would Isaiah do that? Why is there this duplication of material, that which the prophet who wrote Kings, or possibly Ezra, or I think he's Chronicles, or one of the prophets that wrote Kings, and then Isaiah? Why this duplication of information? What did we talk about last week that might tend to answer that question? Michael?
You had the governmental structure and those that would write down the kings and their actions and things like that, but also you'd have the spiritual side of it, like with Isaiah and the kings and what they did in the spiritual manner. So before it wasn't divided like that before, but now it, I guess, it just has two different sides to which. Even with Chronicles, you got so.
While I agree that what you said is true, I don't think that was Isaiah's purpose. Scott? What?
He was rehashing, reiterating things that he'd said in chapter 8, and so maybe that has something to do with it.
Chapter 7, chapter 8, chapter 10 all talked about the Assyrian threat. And we remember very clearly what God said through Isaiah to Ahaz. 7 verse 9, if you will not believe, you will not last. And so he didn't believe, and he hired Assyria to take care of the two minor threats. And then Assyria became chapter 8, the flood that just inundated the entire nation, came right up to the neck, probably the city of Jerusalem. Many of the, probably almost all of the walled and the fortified cities of Judea succumbed to Sennacherib, to the Assyrian invasion. And but chapter 10, if you recall, God said to Assyria, "You think you're something, you're just the axe in my hand. And when I'm finished with you, I'm going to punish you." So there's these prophecies that were made earlier in the book. Now we have this historical record of God keeping his word. And I think that's the key thing of why it's included in Isaiah. It's not different than the others, but it's in a different setting. It's a different context. Or can I say it this way? Isaiah is drawing a big red circle around those four chapters in Kings and say, this is what I'm talking about. And so, but even there, as we explore into 37 tonight, we're going to see some really exciting aspects of future developments in the book of Isaiah. And I've shared some of those with you already, just kind of the seed thought that will sprout as we go along, or the As one nobody says, the egg that will hatch down the road. Okay, so in chapter 36, what regnal year of Hezekiah was it when they were invaded? And corollary question, how old was he at that invasion? Pardon?
14th year.
14th year. How old was he when he became king? 20.
25.
25, so that he would now be 39 years old. See how I can do advanced math right there. And so, your age, he's king and he's got this. What was it like being King Hezekiah in his 39th year? What was it like? You suppose there was any pressure? You suppose there was any talk in the streets about what the king ought to do, and among his counselors about decisions he ought to make, like you could do this or you could do that. I mean, take a look at our nation. there's not a unified voice coming into the ear of President Trump about what to do. And imagine that that's not the first time that's ever happened to a leader. And so you've got the pressures from all sides of making a decision, and then you have the what am I trying to say here? It says early in chapter 36 that all the fortified cities had been taken. How many were there? Do you know? Yeah, I think I've read that there were 42 walled cities in Judea, and the only one that hadn't fallen yet was Jerusalem. And so they've all fallen, which is a testimony to the power of this invading force, and perhaps how long it's been going on. I mean, they don't just fall overnight, one by one by one by one by one. And so Hezekiah's got some pressure on him. And then the Rab Shaka, who was the mouthpiece of Sennacherib. When we get into chapter 37, there's an interesting word that is used by God of the servants of Sennacherib. That'd be Rab Shaka and whoever else came about this message. That word is basically errand boy. Calling this big wig Rab Shaka, your errand boy, your lackey, whatever. Okay, that God's term. I got a kick out of that. So he comes and he starts challenging Hezekiah's confidence. What gives you the confidence to withstand me? Your counsel, that's the first thing he mentioned. Your counsel and your planning, it was useless. Egypt. Now, why would he bring up Egypt? Because they went there, an ally. They hired Egypt to help them. That's useless. You're gonna rely upon your national God, Yahweh. What was the argument that was first made? Don't let Hezekiah,
all the other gods.
Not that, not yet. Because Hezekiah has torn down all of his
Oh,
altars.
yeah.
Say, he's destroyed all of his worship places. God's ticked off at Hezekiah. He's not going to. So Yahweh's useless. And what's this thing about the 2,000 horses? Yeah.
Weren't all of those shrines to other gods?
No. They would be places where high places where they would offer their sacrifices to Yahweh. His sacrifice.
Just a misuse of
Oh, yeah,
sacrifice.
big misuse, a misunderstanding of the purpose and value of sacrifice. Yeah. Yeah, and he did tear down the idolatrous shrines, but that's not the God they're depending upon. They're depending upon Yahweh. Now you got to get this idea. You got to get this idea firmly in your head that all the nations had their national God, who was as strong as their military. That's how strong their national God. I mean, they're, as Hezekiah says in chapter 37, which are not gods, but from the mindset of the Assyrian, your God's no different than our God. How strong is your military? That's how strong your God is. And it's just the God of your nation. And so don't let Hezekiah fool you or deceive you. Deceive you is the word that you use there, and thinking Yahweh will protect you. And then, how many? I'll give you 2,000 horses. If what? If you can find a big enough military to put them on. So you got a useless council and planning. You got a useless ally in Egypt. You got useless Yahweh from a serious standpoint. And you got a useless military. And all these things were coming to Hezekiah. And then Rab Shaka ends up saying, and by the way, do you think I'm here without your God's permission? He told me to come. Now, I don't know if they had been reading chapter 10 or not. But in chapter 10, God said, I send it. And so there's some truth behind that statement, isn't there? But that might simply be the braggadocio of I'm going to talk, I'm going to bluff you down. Okay? And so you've got this eroding confidence. Hezekiah is unable to help you. Yahweh is unable to help you. I can give you vineyards as good as yours, and you'll have peace. And by the way, Yahweh is no better than any of the other gods. This is the point you were making. Say, what about the gods of the various nations? They were not able to deliver their people. And in fact, the really telling piece of that was, who was the God of the 10 northern tribes? Who was the God of Samaria? Yahweh. Boom, they're gone. I already got them. I'm coming after you now. And so we get into chapter, and that's kind of a thumbnail sketch of what we saw in chapter 36.
He obviously, though, didn't understand what was really going on with the ten tribes because Yahweh was not their God.
Well, from a political standpoint,
Yeah.
Yahweh was the God of
But they
that.
were
Yeah.
serving
Oh, they were serving all kinds
all
of gods.
other
Yeah.
gods.
Yeah. But.
Well, he was reading his card wrong.
Yeah.
Amen to that. Okay, so we get then into chapter 37, and I want you to see, I'm going to start in Hezekiah's faithful response. Tell me, as you read verse 1, now this is still review, how did Hezekiah respond to the news that his three guys brought to him from Rabshakeh? First thing he did is he tore his clothes. This a sign of deep grief, deep distress. This is bad. Okay. Second,
And there's nothing I can do.
he covered himself with sackcloth, which is a. Have you ever worn a gunny sack in a race, but not next to your skin?
Itchy.
Yeah, it really, really, really unpleasant. And so it's to afflict. I want to demonstrate how badly afflicted I feel inside by afflicting my outside. Then he went into the house of Yahweh. Now he would not have gone into the temple itself because he wasn't permitted to do so. That was only the priest could go into the temple, but he would go into the courtyard as far as he could go. He went into the house of Yahweh, and then number four, he sent Eliakim to Isaiah. Because what do I do? What do I do? And they said to him in verse 3, and they said to him, thus says Hezekiah, this is a day of distress, rebuke, and rejection. And this is how they took how they how do I want to say this? This was their expression of how they felt that God felt about them. We're being rebuked. We're being rejected. We're being distressed deeply. Now, this next, for children have come to birth and there is no strength to deliver. That's kind of a proverbial saying. We just can't get the job done. We can't get the job done. And we can't. We're helpless. We're hopeless. We cannot do it ourselves. Reminds me of something that Moses said. Guess where I'm going? Moses said, Deuteronomy 32. Yeah. Where? I'm just going to start. We're going to come back to this from time to time. In verse 36, Yahweh will vindicate his people and will have compassion on his servants when he sees that their strength is gone and there's none, bond or free. And he will say, where are they? Where are their gods? The rock in which they sought refuge, who ate the fat of their sacrifices, drank the wine of their libation. Let them rise up and help you. Let them be your hiding place. You see the chiding in that. They're helpless, and their gods that they've been worshiping are useless. See now that I am he, and there is no God besides me. It is I who put to death and give life. I have wounded, and it is I who heal. And there is no who can deliver from my hand? Indeed, I lift up my hand to heaven and say, as I live, God's word by himself, if I sharpen my flashing sword and my hand takes hold on justice, I will render vengeance on my adversaries and repay all those who hate me. I'll make my arrows drunk with their blood. The sword will devour flesh with the blood of the slain and the captives from the long-haired leaders of the enemy. They're all going to die. Rejoice, O nations, his people, for he will avenge the blood of his servants and will render vengeance on his adversaries and will atone for his land, his people. See, nobody could do it. That's the point. Your gods, you couldn't do it. Your gods couldn't do it. The enemies can't do it. I can do it. And this is a theme that we're going to see replicated in the book of Isaiah from time to time, especially when we get to chapter 40. Good stuff in chapter 40. But here he says, this is a day, I'm back in Isaiah 37 now in verse 4. He says, perhaps Yahweh your God will hear the words of Rabshakeh, whom his master, the king of Assyria, has sent to reproach the living God, and will rebuke the words which Yahweh your God has heard. What's the key thought in there to you?
We got this one. Watch the list.
Yeah, he is. Did you see the this is a day of distress, a day of rebuke, a day of rejection. Maybe God will hear what's going on. So leave it up to him to do what needs to be done. A great deal of humility. Therefore, this is Hezekiah asking Isaiah, therefore offer a prayer for the remnant that is left. Now, what jumps out at you when you read the remnant that is left?
Offer a prayer for the ones that are still faithful.
The ones that are still alive.
Yeah, there's been a lot of death.
There has been a flood of the army coming through and wiping out people. We can't deliver. We can't stop it. Everything that he has said is true, except one. And you're the one. Maybe you'll hear. Maybe you'll take pity. Maybe we can reverse this. So verse 5, the servants of King Hezekiah came to Isaiah, and Isaiah said to them, thus you shall say to your master. All right, he's got a response. I don't know, and I won't impute it one way or the other. This could be just leaving out the detail of they told him everything. Or it could be that before, as they got there, God told him everything and gave him the answer, didn't have to hear the plea. You take it however you want to. We know that that was Hezekiah's earnest plea. Whether he had to present it to Isaiah first or not, it doesn't matter because God has an answer. Thus says Yahweh, halfway through verse 6, don't be afraid because of the word you have heard. You remember back in chapter 7 when Ahaz, who was king? Ahaz, what I thought. Okay. Back in chapter 7 when Ahaz was trembling at the words of the king of Israel and the king of Syria. Here, this king, Sennacherib, has already gobbled up those two kings and gobbled up most of Judah's territory. And God says, don't be afraid of him. Does that look counterintuitive to you? Okay. Do not be afraid because of the words that you've heard, which the servants, that word servants there, that's that errand boys, lackeys of King Assyria have blasphemed me. Behold, I will put a spirit in him so that he will hear a rumor and return to his own land. And I'll make him fall by the sword in his own land. Now, the rest of chapter 37 is the fulfillment of that prophecy. I want to ask you this, because it's an important thing to think about. Fulfilled prophecy, according to Moses in Deuteronomy 18, fulfilled prophecy is, and we'll see it come up in chapters 40 through 44 of Isaiah. Fulfilled prophecy is the test of the validity of the one claiming to speak for God. Because God wouldn't lie, and if he says he's going to do it, he's going to do it, all right? And so Think about that. Here he says in verse 7, I'm going to do these. He's going to hear a rumor. He's going to return to his own land. He's going to be killed by the sword. Why? Three things. Now, the end of chapter 37, those three things happen to him. And if you're a skeptic, what do you say about that? It's hard for me to see the time span between when it was said and when it happened. But what makes me think that Isaiah didn't just write this down after it happened, that it was going to happen? I have no way of testing that. But what about a prophecy like he's going to give in of chapter 44 and beginning of 45 about a man named Cyrus who will lay the foundation of the temple? Now, the people that heard that prophecy made are going to be dead long before it happens, because most of them would be dead before Cyrus is even born, much less do what he did. See? And so that prophecy doesn't do anything to solidify their confidence. It would take something really short term, like say it on Thursday and next month it happens. Wow. So that's what this is. That's what Hezekiah is getting this from Isaiah, and it's going to happen in just a day or two. And it's going to be like, wow. I can look at it and say, well, how do I know he didn't write it down after the fact? But I get the prophecy about, what was that guy's name? Cyrus, laying the foundation of the temple. And I know that 100, 200 years later, Cyrus did that very thing. 150 years before he was born, give or take, it was mentioned, God called him by name and said, here's what he's going to do. 50 years after that, he did it. Now, it wouldn't help them, but it sure helps me. See, so some prophecies are designed to help the people of the day. Some prophecies are designed to help the people of a distant day. And so, but the fact is the same in either one. If God said it and it doesn't happen, then whoever spoke was a liar, because God keeps his promises. And we saw that where a couple chapters ago, I think I can remember where we saw that in chapter 20, 30, 'm in Deuteronomy. No wonder I can't find it. It's in Isaiah that I'm supposed to be looking in Deuteronomy. Where is it? Where he says, seek from the book of the Lord. Everyone will have its mate. None of them will be missing. Verse chapter 34, 8, 16. Seek from the book of Yahweh and read. Not one of these will be missing. None will lack its mate. In other words, every prediction will have its fulfillment. Okay. That's, no, it's Isaiah 34, 16. Isaiah 34, 16. And so that's kind of the premise of fulfilled prophecy, that if God said it, it's going to happen. If you present as though you were saying it for God and it doesn't happen, Deuteronomy 18, that's a false prophet. Don't worry about him. Okay, so that's verse 7. 37, verse 8. Then the Rabshakeh returned and found the king of Assyria fighting against Libna, where he heard that the king had left Lachish. And when he heard saying concerning Tirhaka, king of Cush, what's Cush? Ethiopia, right next to Egypt. So probably leading the troops of Egypt as a result of the covenant that they made, the useless covenant. So he's coming. He's coming to fight against you. When he heard that, he sent messengers to Hezekiah saying, this isn't going to help you. Thus you shall say to Hezekiah, verse 60, verse 10, Hezekiah, king of Judah, don't let your God in whom you trust deceive you. Jerusalem shall not be given in the hands of the king of Judah. Don't be deceived by that. Behold, you have heard what I've done to the kings of Assyria. It wasn't just him, but the leading the the vaunted Assyrian army, what we've done to all the lands, destroying them completely, so shall you be spared? So you've got this two-pronged argument against. Verse 12, did the gods of those nations which my father destroyed deliver them? Did their gods deliver? Then watch this next one. Where is the king of Hamath? Verse 13, the king of Arpad, the king of the city of Sepharvaim. What's he? Do you see a difference? Do you see a subtlety here? Our army destroyed their army. They overcame their gods. How do you think that your God is going to protect you? And where are those kings? Make it personal. Those kings are dead. What's going to happen to you, Hezekiah? So he's got the historical truth that Assyria has dominated the gods, and he's got the personal truth, and their kings are dead. Coming at him here. Go ahead.
This just reminds me of something that happened about 300 years earlier when David was just about captured by Saul.
Yeah.
And the Philistines came and drew Saul away.
Yeah.
And Hezekiah knew that.
Mm-hmm.
He's going, I wonder if he was able to, wow, this is just like David and Saul. And look what happened.
Well, David was his what? His great, 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 great grandfather.
Yeah, 300 years earlier.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, good. Then Hezekiah took the letter. Now, watch this. This just, I mean, it touches me emotionally. Hezekiah took the letter from the hand of the messengers, and he read it, and he went up to the house of Yahweh. Now, he's going up there again, right? And he spread it out before Yahweh. Look what he's doing. He asked him earlier, said, listen what they're saying and see what they're doing. This time he opens and says, did God already know the contents of that letter? But he spread it out before. Here, look what they said. Look what they sent. This is a father. I said that wrong. This is like a son who has such intimate confidence in his father. He goes, here's the problem I've got, Dad. Here, look, and spread it all out before him. Take a look at the mess I'm in.
Look at what they're saying.
Yeah.
God.
Yes.
Not only are they saying this, they even wrote it down. That's another level of arrogance.
Another level of arrogance, another level of intimidation,
mm-hmm.
another level of threat.
And another level of disregard for Yahweh.
Yeah. So Hezekiah, so he took the letter, he read the letter, he went to the house of Yahweh and spread out the letter before Yahweh, and then he prayed. He prayed saying, O Yahweh of hosts. What does host mean? Like a hostess? Mm-hmm. Almost.
From the army?
I think of the angels.
The angels? Why do you think of the angels? Okay. Heavenly host. Okay.
Sometimes the stars are
called the host of heaven. It means vast multitudes. And so is often referred to of the advancing army. The mighty host that's coming after us. But you are Yahweh of hosts. You are the God of Israel. You are the God of Israel. And in verse 12, he was worried about the other gods. See, did the gods of those nations? Well, they weren't gods. But you are Yahweh. You the Yahweh of the hosts of heaven. You are the God of Israel. You're enthroned above the cherubim. What does that mean? Enthroned above the cherubim. Or enthroned in or among the cherubim. Picture?
The king of all of the hosts. Just the ruler.
What's a cherubim? What's a cherub? I shouldn't say a cherubim. Cherubim is plural for a cherub. What's a cherub? A
I
pudgy
thought it
little
was.
thing that comes out on Valentine's Day?
No, I thought it was a warrior angel.
Oh,
And doesn't he have an
not
ark
the,
over the
not
ark?
the, leave the word angel off, just a warrior guardian.
Okay, guardian.
A warrior, who is it that stood guard to keep Adam from the tree of life? A cherubim with a flaming sword. The Ark of the Covenant had a mercy seat on it, a mercy seat where God's mercy would rest. By the way, that word mercy seat in the Hebrews 9 passage is the same word that's used in the Romans passage for the cross of Jesus. That mercy seat represented where God's mercy was upon the people. It was a prediction and a prophecy, a prefiguring of the cross of Jesus. What was on the lid of the Ark of the Covenant? You got the mercy seat on top there. What else was on there? Two cherubim guarding it. And when God was about to destroy, according to Ezekiel, chapters 1, and then chapters 10, 11, and 12, 8 through 12, 8 through 11 anyway, when God was about to destroy Jerusalem, just 100 years later, Ezekiel saw a picture of the cherubim attending to the throne of God and then sent to take fire and scatter around the city after God's glory left the city. The glory has departed. Think Matthew 23, where Jesus said, "Your house is left to you desolate." God's glory had departed before they could be destroyed. But it was the cherubim that were responsible for destroying, for being active. Access to the tree of life and for working the wrath of God against his people or any people. You know, what's really interesting about this as I'm going into it is in Exodus 35, God would speak to Moses from between the cherubim on the ark. And then Psalm 18, I want to read this and then I want to get to my really, really interesting point. And Psalm 1 and Psalm 18 verses 1 through 10. That's Isaiah 18, Psalm 18. I love you, O my strength. Yahweh is my rock and my fortress, my deliverer, my God, my rock in whom I take refuge. Now, this is, you look at the ascription. The ascription is part of the Hebrew text. Psalm of David, a servant of Yahweh, who spoke to Yahweh the words of this song in the day that Yahweh delivered him from the hand of all of his enemies and from the hand of Saul. And he said, okay, so this is his praise for the deliverance that he received. Verse 4, the cords of death encompassed me, and the torrents of ungodliness terrified me. The cords of Sheol surrounded me, and snares of death confronted me. What do you suppose that is? Remember the story you were telling about David and his men on one side of the mountain and Saul on the other side of the mountain? Don't think Mount Rainier. The mountains there weren't, they were rugged, but they weren't near that big. They could probably hear each other. They were that close. Saul and his 3,000, and David had 600, and they were that close. And this is how he described his emotions of that. In my distress, I called upon Yahweh and cried to my God for help. He heard my voice out of his temple, and my cry for help before him came into his ears. The earth shook and quaked, and the foundations of the mountains trembling and were shaken because he was angry. Why was he angry? Because they were trying to hurt his anointed. God was angry when they got after David. You always ought to remember that. If you're a servant of God, he gets angry when his people are upset. One of the pictures that is just vivid in my mind, as they were stoning Stephen to death, what did he say? I see the Son of Man standing at the right hand of God. But earlier in the text of Acts, he sat down at the right hand of God. Get the picture. They're going to do that to my son? My child, my brother, and he stood up. See? And so get this picture of God rallying to the Spartan defense of his people. Smoke went out from his nostrils, verse 8, and fire from his mouth devoured. Coals were kindled by it. He bowed the heavens also and came down with thick darkness under his feet. And he rode upon a cherub and flew, and he sped upon the wings of the wind. This is David describing, I know poetically, describing how God came to his defense, but notice that the cherub was involved. Now, go back to the Garden of Eden, chapter 3 of Genesis, and God sent a cherubim to guard access to the tree of life with flaming swords so that man couldn't take of it. When the tree of life is presented again in the book of Revelation, how many cherubim were guarding access to it? None of them. They were in chapter 4 of Revelation, they were the four living creatures around the throne of God, praising God for what he had accomplished, but they weren't banning man from the tree of life anymore. But I perhaps gave you more information about cherubim than was necessary, maybe even prudent, but I got excited about it. Hope you did too. That you, he says, are enthroned there. You have the control over these guardian warriors. You are the God, you alone of all the kingdoms of the earth. Now, what about the gods of these nations who my father destroyed? Gozan and Haran and Rezeph and the sons of Eden and Telassar. What about those gods? They weren't God. You alone are the God of all the kingdoms of the earth. You have made heaven and earth. Now, I don't know if you want to take that literally, that is terra firma and the expanse of heaven, or if you want to take that covenantally. Heaven and earth were the covenant system that they lived in. And when we get to toward the end of the book, he's going to make new heavens and new earth when Messiah comes. Got to get rid of the heavens and earth that were Mosaic and bring in a new heavens and new earth, which are messianic, which in the book Revelation is the bride, the New Jerusalem that came down out of heaven. Okay, so I take it that way because of the way Isaiah uses this concept throughout the book. The heavens and earth here is not talking about terra firma and the air we breathe or the sidereal where the stars are, but the covenant relationship. You made that for man to be with you. Incline your ear, O Yahweh. That's request number one. Open your eyes, O Yahweh. Doesn't that look like what he said earlier in the book? Open your eyes, O Yahweh, and see, listen to all the words of Sennacherib who sent them to reproach the living God. What does that remind you of? Taunting the living God, taunting the armies of the living God, reminds me of David and Goliath. That's who I think of. David and Goliath, and how that David accused Goliath of blaspheming and taunting the armies of the living God. Oh Yahweh, truly. Now look at that verse 18. Truly. Every time you see truly, what do you think? It was the first four or the first syllable there. True. He's right. Everything Sennacherib said about his exploits is accurate. Truly, O Yahweh, the kings of Assyria have devastated all the countries and their lands. And they have cast their gods into the fire, for they were not gods, but the work of men's hands. We're going to have a really interesting chapter in a little while, within 10 chapters, where Isaiah just he ridicules the idea of making a god out of a tree you just cut down. I mean, think about it, Alan. I've got a God in that tree right there, but he can't even keep me from cutting him down. So how's he going to deliver me from my enemies? So, but they're gods. They're made. They're not gods. They're made from human hands. By the way, handmade versus made without hands. When you read the phrase "made without hands," what do you think of? Like a circumcision made without hands, or a a temple made without hands. What do you think
Made
of it?
by
Made by God.
God.
A stone cut without hands to hit the statue in the feet. Made by God. These were all handmade. What God makes is out without human hands. Like Paul said on Mars Hill, that you shouldn't think that the divine image is served by human hands as though he needed anything. Okay, it's Acts 17. Okay, handmade. Truly, and they're the right. They did conquer all those lands and they did throw their gods into the fire, but they weren't gods. So they have destroyed them. And now, Yahweh our God, deliver us from his hand. Watch this. That all the kingdoms of the earth may know that you alone, Yahweh, why is that important? Is that just an arrogance? That all the earth, all the nations of the earth, all the kingdoms of the earth may know that you alone are God. This God, that God, that God, they fell to the hands of the Assyrians because they weren't gods. Is there a God that the nations can depend on that won't fall? Why is it important that all the nations know that Yahweh is the one true God? Not Allah, not any of the others, any of the 300,000 that the people of Egypt are. India. Thank you. I knew it started with an I. Why is this important? Come on, this is an important question. Why is it important? Paul, I mean, he's not being arrogant, is he? It's not like my school is better than your school. See, I graduated from Kent Meridian High School, and our biggest rival was not Auburn, Renton. They're a bigger school. They always beat us at football. They always beat us at basketball. But we would go, and we said our school's best. Is that what he's doing here? No. I want all the nations and the kingdoms of the earth to know that you alone are God. Why is that important?
So that they could worship the true God.
Yeah, here's a couple of passages. We'll take a look at chapters 43, 44, and 45. Not all the chapters, but some verses in each. In chapter 43, 8. He says, bring out the people who are blind, even though they have eyes, and deaf, even though they have ears. He's talking about his, we'll get that when we get there. All the nations have gathered together in order that the peoples may be assembled. Who among them can declare this? What God can tell you what I'm about to tell you? Who among them can declare this and proclaim to us the former things? That's what you predicted long ago that's coming true now. Let them present their witnesses that they may be justified, or let them hear and say, it's true. You are my witnesses, declares Yahweh, and my servant whom I've chosen, in order that you may know and believe me and understand that I am he. Before me there was no God formed, and there will be none after me. I am Yahweh, and there is no Savior beside me. Why is it important that all the kingdoms of the world know that you're Yahweh? It's the only way they can be saved. Isn't that simple? Only way they can be saved. Chapter 44, verse 6. Thus says Yahweh, the King of Israel, and his Redeemer, Yahweh of hosts, the same guy. I am the first, I am the last, and there is no God besides me. And who is like me? Let him proclaim and declare it. Do you want to be God? Tell us what you said was going to happen, that has already happened, and tell us now what's going to happen in the future so when we see it, we can know. Let him recount it to me in order from the time that I established ancient nations and let them declare to them the things that are coming and the events that are going to take place. Don't tremble or be afraid. Have I not? Isn't that what he said to Hezekiah? Don't tremble, don't fear. Have I not long ago announced it to you and declared it? You are my witnesses. Is there any God besides me? Or is there any rock? I know of none. And that's enough on that point. I'll give you, just toss it in, chapter 45, verses 20 and 21. Say pretty much the same thing. But you see, I asked the question, why is it important that all the kingdoms of the earth know that Yahweh is the only God there is? because he's still our Savior. All right?
Nimrod,
Yeah.
there's good people in those other nations.
Yeah.
And their only mistake is they're worshiping false gods. And but God knows the heart and he wants those people.
Yeah, and I'm going to leave that totally up to him. Of what are you going to do with people who haven't heard about him, but have the kind of heart that would follow him?
But this declaration, these kings need to know this so that they can worship me.
Yeah, and so that they can...
God, not me.
Yeah, and so that they can share this with their populace.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
It's being kind to them.
Right. So, got to hurry because we got a lot to cover here in this next little bit. Then... So here's Hezekiah praying. This is Hezekiah's prayer. Yeah, just, I mean, that's a great prayer. Then Isaiah, the son of Amoz, sent to Hezekiah saying, thus says Yahweh, the God of Israel, because you have prayed to me about Sennacherib, the king of Assyria, because you laid it out before me, because you inquired of me, because you pleaded with me, this is the word that Yahweh has spoken against him. Now, I want you to look in this next and tell me who she is and who you is. She has despised you and mocked you, the virgin daughter of Zion. She has shaken head behind you, the daughter of Jerusalem. Who's the she and who's the you?
Samaria is the she.
And?
You are Jerusalem.
And so the you could be the virgin daughter of Zion. Or the she could be the virgin. The daughter of Zion is laughing at you. I mean, you can take it either way. Okay? You have been mocking my daughter, my wife. Or my virgin daughter is laughing at you. Take it either way because both fit. Right? Whom have you reproached and blasphemed? So here, the you now is the king of Assyria. So I don't know that he's switching pronouns. The you obviously is the king of Assyria in verse 23. Whom have you reproached and blasphemed? Against whom have you raised voice and haughtily lifted up your eyes? Ha ha! God, you can't stop me. Against the Holy One of Israel. Through your servants, that is your errand boys, your lackeys, you have reproached Yahweh. He sent a boy to do a man's job, is what he said. But who did he send? The Rabshakeh, this high official. But God said, you sent a boy to do a man's job. And you have said, with me, my many chariots, I came up to the heights of the mountains, to the remotest parts of Lebanon, and I cut down all the tall timbers and its choice cypresses. You want to go back and remember chapter 10? You are the axe in my hand. You're saying, I cut him down. You're bragging about what you did. And I will go to his highest peak in the thickest forest. I dug wells, drank waters, and with the sole of my feet, I dried up all the rivers of Egypt. In other words, there was no barrier, water or otherwise, that kept me from plundering Egypt. You remember when God brought Israel out of Egypt? He opened up the Red Sea. Well, the Assyrian is saying, I don't need God to open the Red Sea for me. I'll just go in there and take it. There are other ways to get into Egypt rather than just going through the Red Sea. So, I mean, that's why they had to dig the Suez Canal, right? They had to dig a canal to connect the Mediterranean to the Red Sea. So there was obviously ways to get in other than across that sea. But that's, I belabor the point. What he's saying is, I got this, I got that, I took this, I climbed that, I the water couldn't keep me out. And then God responded in verse 26, have you not heard? Long ago, I did it. Now this, if you remember what we read in the future, there in chapter 43 and 44, who planned in the past and has come true now? Who is planning now that will come true later? It says, long ago, I planned for you to do this stuff. I planned it. From ancient times, I planned it. And now I have brought it to pass. That's an interesting thing about the things God said he's going to do. You remember back in chapter 9 at verse 7, after that series of things about to us a child was born, all that, he says, the zeal of Yahweh of hosts will accomplish this. Here he says, long ago I did it, I planned it, and now I have brought it to pass that you should turn fortified cities into ruinous heaps. Therefore, that I planned it a long time ago, I brought it to pass now. Therefore, their inhabitants were short of strength. These other nations that you conquered, they were short of strength because I wanted you to conquer them. I wanted you to subdue them. They were dismayed and put to shame. They were as vegetation of the field or as the green herb, as the grass on the housetops is scorched before it is grown up. What's his point on those two lines? Just use your analyzing skill. Have you ever seen grass growing on the housetop?
It doesn't
Around here,
mature.
maybe it's in the gutters. Pardon?
The moss.
Or the moss, but it doesn't come to fruition. It doesn't. It dries up. It dries up. Okay. As grass on the housetop is scorched before it is grown up. And so, think about this. I wrote this note to myself on this verse. On the therefore. Therefore, I planned it long ago. I brought it to pass now. Therefore, not your prowess, but my power enabled you to conquer these nations. You're just an axe. Chapter 10. Why are you bragging? You're just an axe in my hand. I'm doing a job with you. Okay? But I know you're sitting down, and you're going out, and you're coming in, and you're raging against me. Because of your raging against me, and because of your arrogance, and because your arrogance has come up to my ears, therefore, since you're out here blowing your little ooga horn on your Model T compared to God's almighty tank, as it were, since you're out here bragging about what you've done and what you're going to do and saying, nobody can stand up to me, why do you think you can stand up to me? Or none of the gods could ward me off. Why do you think your God can ward me off? Because of your arrogance. Therefore, I will put my hook in your nose. You see the irony there? Anybody see the irony in that? I'll put my hook in your nose. Tell us.
With the Assyrian.
That's what they did to their captors. They put their hooks in their noses and drug them off. He said, I'll put my hook in your nose. And my bridle in your lips, and I will turn you back by the way which you came. So that's God's answer to Hezekiah. All right. So the rest of the story comes next. Then this shall be the sign for you. Okay, you want a sign? Sign? Everywhere there's signs. You shall eat this year what grows of itself. Whatever you can forge. In the second year, what springs forth from the same. And in the third year, sow, reap, plant vineyards, and eat their fruit. How do you recover from a national tragedy like this? A little bit at a time. You'll eat what grows up. Next year, there'll be seeds that have fallen and eat from that. After that, you'll be able to save enough seed to plant your own fields. And that's a sign that's going to take how long? 3 years. And you're going to do something tomorrow about a sign and give me a sign that's going to take 3 years. Okay. Okay. And you'll see it. You'll see me keep my promise. You'll see how splendid it is when I keep my promise to you. What do you suppose God's doing with that? Here's what I think. I think he loves Israel so much that even though they're as wicked as they were, that would cause him to allow this to happen, spank them, punish them, but I really want to bless you. I really want to pour my blessings out on you. I think he's trying to win their hearts. I think he's trying to win their devotion, their allegiance, their affection. That's what I think, okay? He says in verse 31, and the surviving remnant of the house of Judah shall again take root downward and bear fruit upward. For out of Jerusalem shall go forth a remnant, and out of Mount Zion survivors. If the offspring of Abraham were going to be as numerous as the stars of heaven, and God really had in mind not the physical nation of Israel, but his spiritual offspring, this lineage had to survive to bring the Messiah into existence. I'm going to do this for the survivors of Zion. I'm going to make sure that there's a remnant of survivors. We saw them back in chapter 4 and other places, but 4 is really, really significant. 4, there's only 6 verses there. Go back and read that again. And the idea of in the last days there will be the remnant, the survivors. Okay. Verse 32. Remnant shall go forth, the survivors of Mount Zion, because the zeal of Yahweh of hosts shall perform this. There again, right down 9, verse 7, Isaiah 9, 7. The zeal of Yahweh getting it done. What is zeal? Passion, fervor, el fuego, if you're Spanish, the fire inside. I am so passionate about my bride, I'm going to make sure she comes through this okay. Therefore, and there's a therefore, verse 33, therefore, thus says Yahweh concerning the king of Assyria. He's not going to come to this city. In fact, he never did. He is not going to shoot an arrow there, neither shall he come before it with a shield, nor throw up a mound against it. There was no siege laid against Jerusalem. It wasn't that they were under siege and then he delivered them. He didn't even let the army get close enough to do the work of besieging the city. By the way that he came, by the same way he shall return, and he shall not come to this city, declares Yahweh, for I will defend this city for and save it for my own sake and for my servant David's sake. I will defend this city. I will defend this city. How does Yahweh do? Do you feel the protection? Do you feel the protection? Go back, I don't know, a couple hundred years. King David, I'm foggy on my timeline here, but David was in the city of Gath, fleeing from Saul. The king of Gath, Achish, the king of Gath, welcomed him gladly. He's a mighty warrior. But then some of his people said, isn't that the one they sing about? Saul is fleeing his thousands, David his 10,000s. David heard them saying that, and so he started pretending like he was a madman. He drooled into his beard and he scribbled on the wall. And the king said, I don't need another madman. But when you read Psalm 34, you read what David was doing everything he knew. Feign madness and maybe they'll kick me out. But it says in Psalm 34, this poor man cried and Yahweh heard him. Verse 7, you've got to remember Psalm 34, 7. Because the angel of Yahweh encamps around those who fear him and delivers them. You just got to remember that. In Zechariah 2, the first vision that's in chapter 2 was of a young man going out to measure the walls of the New Jerusalem. And God said, hey, tell him he doesn't need to do that. The city is going to be growing so much. I'll be a wall. I'll be a wall tower around her. I will protect my people. In 2 Chronicles 16, about verse 9, God chastised King Asa, who had hired a foreign army to help him fend off an invasion. He says, you've acted foolishly. Don't you know that the eyes of Yahweh roam to and fro the entire earth, so that he might strongly support those whose heart is completely his? You've acted foolishly. I guess what I'm trying to say is, I will defend this city. Didn't stop with Hezekiah's, because we saw it with David before. We see it in the promise of Hezekiah later, and Zechariah. I mean, I guess what I'm wanting to say is, this wasn't an isolated event of God stepping up to defend his people. I just want you to know that you're under the protection of God. In fact, I think Allstate borrowed the concept. You're in good hands. But Jesus said, nobody can snatch you out of my Father's hand. You're in good hands. All right, epilogue. Then the angel of Yahweh went out, and 185,000 in the camp of the Assyrians. And when men arose early in the morning, behold, all of these were dead. So Sennacherib, didn't God say, I'm going to put a rumor and he's going to head back? Then Sennacherib, king of Assyria, departed and returned and lived at Nineveh. And it came about as he was worshiping in the house of Nisroch. Well, who's Nisroch? His God. Okay? Now, I want you to think of the ironies that's coming up here. None of the gods of these nations were able to protect them from me. So here he is, he's worshiping at his God. And his own sons come and kill him right there in the temple. Think of the irony of that. And they escaped, and his son Esarhaddon became king in his place. Any thoughts? That's all I wanted to cover with you tonight. I was animated by studying this and getting ready for it, and just the wow factor, the amazement. And it's easy to see now, in retrospect, why this isn't just a duplication of what you had in First Kings or Second Kings. It's a very important part of the storyline of Isaiah. Very important part of my God keeps his promises. I'm the only savior you have. And this is what's coming up, because his people at this time were not trusting him to be their savior. Okay. Next week we'll finish 38 and 39. You'll see one of them is pretty short. And then we'll get into the good stuff.
Sentence, when they woke up, they were all dead.
It wasn't the ones that woke up that were dead.
I think it's an oxymoron.
I think there were enough people still alive to go back to Nineveh. And when they woke up, all these were dead, the 185,000. I think that's the way to take it. Any closing thoughts?